welcome to Radio Gorgeous, Lindsay Fitzharris, who is shortlisted for the Welcome Book Prize, which will be awarded this evening, April 30th, for her book, The Butchering Art, which is about fabulous Victorian surgery.
Welcome. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know how fabulous it is. It depends on, you know, how much you like blood and guts, but, you know.
Blood, guts, gore. I mean, these guys, I think these guys, reading your book, I think these guys are where we got the idea that surgeons got this cocky godlike.
Yeah, actually, at the time that, this is early 19th century, surgeons were very much seen as craftsmen. They were men who worked with their hands. So they weren't really respected like physicians were. It's only more recently that the surgeons kind of reached the top of the hierarchy. But there are some bigger-than-life characters that sort of appear in this book. There's a guy named Robert Liston. He's 6'2". He's incredibly tall for this period. He could hold you down with his left arm, take your leg off in under 30 seconds. And he makes a name for himself for removing a 45-pound scrotal tumor in under 4 minutes without any anesthesia. That's not 4 to 5 pounds. It's 45 pounds. I have no idea how it got that size. Like,
you'd think you'd go to the extreme of, like, not go to the doctor till
right? I know, late. Like, 10 pounds. You think, like, that would be, that's, like, more than a bowling ball? Like, that just seems so uncomfortable.
Say, well, the standard size is the size of a grapefruit. Did they not have grapefruit?
Yeah. So this poor guy goes in, you see Robert Liston, he removes it in under 4 minutes. No anesthesia. It was brutal. The guy survives. So that's the kind of surgeon you'd want before the advent of anesthesia. But the problem is that people don't understand that germs exist. So these operations are incredible. Like, they don't wash their hands or their instruments. Everything is very dirty. The operating table itself is covered in blood. It wouldn't necessarily be wiped down between patients.
It was sort of like a badge of honor. It's like, these are the tools of my trade, including the gore left from the
guy. Oh, yeah. You would want to carry that. The surgeons would carry around a cadaverous smell of rotting flesh, which those in the profession called good old hospital stink. So this was the world that Joseph Lister, which my book is about, this is the world he steps into in the 1840s. And Lister is ultimately the one who develops antiseptic surgery. So he saved thousands of people's lives in his own time, and he continues to save people's lives because we operate knowing that germs exist.
Yes, because that was the thing that was so mysterious. They were doing everything they could. These weren't people who just, you know, liked to slice and dice.
Yeah.
But, you know,
they enjoyed a little bit of that.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, especially Liston.
Yeah.
Indiscriminate.
Indiscriminate, yeah.
Fingers go off.
Yeah.
Anyway,
he used to even put notches in his knife, you know, every time he did a patient. So there you go.
But they did care. They did want to save lives.
Yes.
And it was quite mysterious to Lister that the body has an incredible, that everyone knows, the body has an incredible capacity to heal. So why do 50% of the people we're carving up die?
Right. Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I mean, these surgeons, bigger than life they are to us today, it's kind of funny to us today. They were risking their own lives. This is before mass antibiotics. It's before vaccinations. So it was a very dangerous time to go into medicine. And surgeons, doctors, they died all the time because they were exposed to all these diseases. And they couldn't figure out what was killing their patients. You're right. And it must have been really frustrating to constantly go into the operating theater, amputate, and your patient died of gangrene or septicemia. I also like to remind people that although we understand that germs exist, we're still fighting this in hospitals. It's super bugs. I've been seeing a lot of super gonorrhea out there in the news.
They're calling it super.
Super gonorrhea. Yeah, this like sort of incurable strain of gonorrhea. And gonorrhea is just, as a side note, is of interest to me because Listerine, so most people know Joseph Lister's name because of Listerine. He didn't create it. And it wasn't even used as a mouthwash in the 19th century. It was used to treat gonorrhea. But it was named for him, or sort of in honor of him. And I'm sure Listerine's going to come and sue me at some point because I keep telling people it was a cure for gonorrhea. Just throw some Listerine
just on
it. It'll be fine, yeah.
It's all good. But also, tell me more about his story, because he was not of that normal ilk. Of surgeon. He was a Quaker.
He was
a quiet,
yeah.
sort of guy.
Yeah, and, you know, we're sitting here in the Wellcome Trust, and these were the streets that he would have been walking around as a medical student. The Quaker House is right to the side of us.
And
he,
University.
And, the yeah, University College London, where he went to medical school. So this was very much Lister's world. It's actually something I hadn't thought about till this moment. To be up for this prize and sort of be on Lister's turf is really wonderful. But he was a very quiet man. He was very religious. And he didn't really, I always deal with him as sort of someone pushed towards his fate. He has a mental breakdown. He leaves medical school. He wonders what could medicine do after his brother dies. And he keeps getting pushed back into it. And his father is really instrumental in helping him realize his place in history. So I think he's sort of, today, he's sort of the hero we need because science is constantly under attack at the moment. And here's this man who stood behind his data, he stood behind his science, and he ultimately changes the world.
Yes, and that's fantastic. But I want,
But that did not answer your question.
No, that's no. Fine. But, and I also want people to read the book because there's some extraordinary things and is written in a very... galvanizing, page-turning kind of way.
It's narrative nonfiction. It should read like a novel. And yes. I'm a historian by training, but I'm a storyteller first and foremost. So I really wanted to kind of get the fastest pace. You know, you go into a bookstore and there's this giant book, and you know, maybe it's about, you know, George Washington, and you just think, I might be interested in that. Do I really have the time to dedicate to it? So I wanted this to be fast-paced. People who aren't familiar with medical history or medicine or science, like they don't read that kind of genre, hopefully will find it accessible.
Okay, and so in your background was history of science and medicine.
Yes.
What drew you to that?
Yeah, it's a real thing. people are like, medical history, that's
well,
made up.
Makes sense.
But I came over, I have this Chicago accent, I've been here for a long time. I came over as an undergrad, and I was introduced to the history of science by a man named Robert Fox at Oxford, and I just stayed for my master's, my PhD. The Wellcome Trust ended up funding my postdoc, but at that point I'd become intellectually burnt out. So I decided to start a blog, which I called The Surgeon's Apprentice, and I wanted to fall back in love with history, like the things that got me excited as a little girl about the past. It just was meant to be a hobby project, and it just kind of took off, and I realized that that's what I was really passionate about doing.
I was gonna say, and you have a YouTube series.
I do, yeah.
Called Under the Knife. And such fun things as reusable condoms are explored. And it is, they are short snippets, but they do really give you a real eye into some of the more
weird things.
More salacious and sort of wacky things.
I mean, my friends are involved in that. My friend Alex Anstey, he films them for me. And the reusable condom was really fun. He brought this like giant inflatable costume. And he's like, it's not about you, Lindsay. Don't be precious. You have to put this reusable, inflatable condom outfit on to present this very serious, you know, segment on the history of condoms. So we have a lot of fun with it. And it's been a delight because adults like it, but I get a lot of kids coming to it saying, oh, this is a really great subject. So for me, that's really rewarding.
And the Wellcome Prize for Books, just to get to that, because I suspect your next book will probably also be shortlisted.
Oh, well, that's a great prediction. We're locking this down right here.
This book is bringing fiction or nonfiction experiences of science, medicine, life, and death.
Right. Yeah.
And I think you're of a person that thinks we don't talk about death enough.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, we don't. I mean,
it's on the way.
Yeah. It's just. I mean, this is why people are so curious about my pages and my YouTube series. There is a morbid curiosity that is there largely because we just don't interact with death anymore. And one of the shortlisted books, With the End in Mind, which is an amazing book by a palliative care physician who's trying to open up these discussions, because natural deaths aren't really depicted in the media. And so whenever we talk about death, it's usually sort of exceptional deaths or violent deaths. So her book's amazing. I have her pegged as the winner tonight. So, but all of the books on the list are great. And as you say, it's a weird prize because it's fiction, it's nonfiction, it's everything. It's a free for all. So it's hard to sort of weigh up the books against each other. But over the last 48 hours, I've met these other authors, and they're great, and all of their books are amazing. So all worthy of the prize.
Excellent. Your book is dedicated to your grandmother.
Yes.
Tell me about your
My grandma's still alive. She's out there in Chicago, and she goes to the bookstore and points this out to people. You know, is it, my granddaughter wrote this book. My grandmother raised me, partly raised me, when my parents had a divorce, and she and I share a love of the past, a love of history, and we are cemetery goers. So she, you know, I would drag her from the cemetery to cemetery, and we'd go hunting ghosts when I was a little girl. But I just always loved the past, and I think I was always fascinated with the people who lived in the past. What were their experiences? But she definitely has a little bit of a morbid curiosity. There's a grave in one of our family cemeteries, and it's like a big tomb. And you can, when I was little, you could look in this window and see the casket. She'd always get up there and look. Well, now they boarded it up, probably because my grandma has been peeking in on these poor remains, you know, this whole time. But every time I go back to Chicago, she gets in her Audi. She's 88. We drive around to the graveyards, and it's wonderful.
Fantastic. And is there anything you can tell us about your next book? I think you're at the beginning of plastic surgery.
Yeah. So my next book is on a guy named Harold Gillies, who's the father of plastic surgery. He was rebuilding soldiers' faces during World War I. And, I mean, faces that were just decimated and torn off. And he was incredible because he taught himself how to draw. He surrounded himself with artists. My husband, Adrian Teal, he's a caricaturist. And so we both have a real interest in how this story is going to come together. It feels like a Spielberg movie to me. So if Spielberg's listening, I got a story for you. But it is an epic tale of these soldiers, of this man who tries to give them back their identities. Because losing your arm in World War I made you a hero. But losing your face made you a monster. Mm-hmm. So,
excellent. Well, the best of luck tonight.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We're looking forward to the next Under the Knife.
Thank you. Yes, I know. I got to get back to that. I know. If I ever get a chance, they have me running here and there. But it's really wonderful to see the interest in these subjects again.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thanks.